Aloha, everyone, and welcome to Aquarian Radio at AquarianRadio.com. I'm your host, Janet Carol Lesson, with my co-host, Dr. Sasha Lesson. And today we have a very special episode of Aquarian Radio. We're going to do an Anunnaki roundtable discussion, and we have Alex Teplish calling in. He's a researcher from New York area. Robert Evans is another Anunnaki researcher from California. And I think we just got Neil Freer, and we're going to introduce him first. And we have, of course, Dr. Sasha Lesson, and I am your co-host, Janet Carol Lesson. Dr. Lesson, would you like to say something first?
Oh, this is great to have Neil, to have you here. It is really tremendous. We've all been studying the works of Zachariah Sitchin very, very intensely and learning everything we can about our true history, because that history is what can free us from the matrix that was imprinted on us and perpetrated in a way that's just stifling our consciousness. And so I'm so glad to have this round table and especially to hear you talk, Neil.
So I'm going to unmute Neil, and we're going to start with you, Neil, because you're you're the senior here, and we're so fortunate you're here. Thank you so much. And 1 second. Okay, come on. There we go. Hi, Neil. Welcome to our show. Is that you, Neil? Okay. Caller number 513, not sure who that is. Okay, I'm going to put you back on mute until I figure this out. Okay. Well, let's start with Dr. Lesson. What would you like to tell us about the Anunnaki research?
Okay, 450,000 years ago or so, these big, tall, 8 to 12 foot tall, human beings like us, only way bigger, and they lived a lot longer, came to Earth to get gold, and they settled in the Persian Gulf area and traced the flecks of gold there down to Africa. And they started mining in Southeast Africa, and they were taking the gold back to their planet to turn into white powder of monoatomic gold and float up in their atmosphere and so forth. And so they created a slave race. Their genome, plus a few Neanderthal genes, their smart hominoid, the ancestor of Sasquatch that was here, and added a little copper and a little minerals from the clay of Africa, and they used their own mitochondrial DNA from their chief medical officer, Ninma, the princess, and they created us, and then we're an illegal slave race that wasn't supposed to be created by the rules they were going by of galactic society. And their commander said, let them drown. And when there was going to be a big disturbance, because they knew Nibiru was coming through and the Antarctic ice sheet was going to slide into the South Sea and cause the deluge. But one of their numbers, the chief scientist, the one who genetically created us, Enki, gave his son a computer disk in his wall of his hut that told him how to make a submersible, and he took his craftsman, and they were able to, with Enki's son driving it, land on Mount Ararat and so forth. And they decided to rebreed the Earthlings and just get operations going again on Earth, rule through Noah's, that's the son of Enki, his sons, and these people were so warlike and so obsessed with hierarchy, they're willing to bomb each other and kill each other and murder huge armies of Earthlings. Just they don't know what they're fighting for, and these guys had laser weapons and bombs. And Janet wants to say something.
I forgot. I wanted to introduce everybody first before I went into the story, so I'm sorry. So just pause right there for 1 moment. And remember, that's what we're going to do. So I'm going to real quick dial and see if we can get Neil on, and then we'll go into the story more. Bear with us. Thank you. Oh, wait. There he is. Okay, cancel that.
Hello.
Hi, Neil. I see you're on the show. Okay, you're 513 area code. I'm going to pull you onto the show. Hi. Okay, Neil Freer, I think we've got you live on the show. Do we have the right person?
This is Joe.
No. Okay, sorry. Let me put you on hold. I'm confused. Okay, hold on 1 second. I'm going to go back and call one more time. Let's let Robert talk, and I'm keeping track of these phone numbers here. Okay, hold on. Robert Evans?
Yes.
Hi, Robert. I'm sorry. I'm
no
screwing
problem.
Up here.
That's
so
right.
Go ahead and tell us a bit who you are, and I'm going to dial and get Neil on. Okay,
sure.
Let me just do this real quick. Go ahead. Start talking, and we'll see if he answers the phone. I think I screwed up, but let's try this again.
No problem. Well, I was born and raised here in San Francisco, California. Married my sweetheart from high school. We've been married ever since. We're getting ready to get on 39 years. I ran for a U.S. Congress back during 1996 and also in 1998 against Democrat Tom Lantos. Unfortunately, I didn't make it, but I've always had...
Hi, Neil.
Hello.
Is this Neil? Hi. Is this Neil?
Yes, hi.
Hi, this is
Janet.
Aquarian Radio. Yeah, this is Janet. We've got you live. Let me have you up, and then we'll have you come on, okay?
Okay, sure.
Thank you. Okay. Go ahead, Robert. Finish your introduction.
Sure. I've been researching the Anunnaki and Nibiru and what NASA's been actually been recording since 1998, all these huge UFOs that come into our system, and that's been keeping me going all these years, and I've been posting them onto Facebook and onto a couple of videos I've done. I've been on several different radio shows talking about this. I've also spoken at UFO Con 213. Last year, and that's about it right there.
Okay, thank you. We'll come back. We're just going to get everybody in on an introduction, and then we'll come around full circle, and we'll just start the question. So next, I'm going to pull Neil Freer on. Okay. Hi, Neil. Welcome to the show. We're doing an Anunnaki roundtable, and
yes.
This first round, we're just all going to say who we are, and... introduce yourself to the audience and to each other. I think a lot of people have heard about you, but let's just, for our new people, tell them who you are and your research on the Anunnaki.
Okay. Well, let's see. I started way back at 12 years old when I was, abducted, but I was contacted by the Anunnaki, middle of the night, to make a very short piece of it. They asked me very politely at 12 to 13 years old to introduced into the planet. And in hindsight, I would say that it was a matter of reintroduction on their part, but of course I didn't have any information at all about them, but they were so polite and respectful and in earnest that I said yes, and at that point the large gray sergeant of arms that was in charge of the operation that was actually doing the direct contact of me, shoved this big ball of information in my head, and I was a junkie, information junkie by the time. and so he put this big ball of information in my head, and I thought, wow, that's information, but I don't know, I can't understand any of it. And he gave me to believe that it would be meant for much later on, like maybe when I was 70 years old. And so it has turned out that way. One of the they also pulled back a curtain, showed me who the actual the gray sergeant pulled back a curtain to show me who was the CEO of the operation, and it turned out to be one of the Anunnaki, very big husky gentleman with a very big bushy Semitic beard and stuff, white robe, not a god figure by any means. He was very,
you know
very
who
human,
it was?
Humanoid. I suspect it was Enki, although I never got a name. And at that point, he told me that because they appreciated so much my agreeing to offer to help them get into the planet, introduction-wise again, that they would take care of me for the rest of my life. And I've seen it happen. You know, I've seen it subtly happen many, many times where they've watched out for me in certain circumstances. So anyway, that was the very beginning of it. But then, and so I always have had the interest, and by the time of, let's see, I think it was 1976, we were living in Woodstock, New York, and I was running my own business, and there was a paper called the Kingston Freeman, and I didn't think very much of it and very seldom have ever read it, but there was a new copy on the coffee table, and when I walked into the living room, this voice in my head practically said, pick up that thing and read it. And the first article that my eyes saw when I picked up that was the pre-publication information about Zechariah Sitchin's first book and the 12th planet. And I immediately realized that, uh-oh, here we go. You know, we're going to get active here. And so it subsequently intensely involved in this topic and also becoming friends with Dr. Sitchin. I have written subsequently three books on Breaking the God Spell, God Games, What Do You Do Forever, and third book, which is in Kindle form so far only through Amazon. All of these books are on Amazon, through Amazon. The third book is only Kindle, and it's called Sapiens Rising, The View from 2100. And because I'm by now 84, I was 12 years old when they enlisted me, and a bit frustrated that things aren't going as fast as they really ought to, as far as disclosure is concerned. I've got together with a good friend and associate, C.B. Scott Jones, whose name you probably know, and Scott is a rather exceptional character. He was a carrier pilot in the Korean War at the same time I was a conscientious objector starting out. And then he went there from there to Naval Intelligence. And he at one time was a briefer at the White House, I guess, while still in Naval Intelligence. And then he went to work for Senator Pell, who was an exceptional character. And Senator Pell sent him around the world to investigate the leading-edge work being done in the paranormal and UFOs.
Neil, I'll say that again. We just lost you for a moment. Paranormal and UFOs, and then you went blank. Say that again, please.
Oh, I have
Pell.
I have the spells, maybe. Anyway.
I think the phone went blank. It wasn't you.
No.
You were talking.
Yeah.
The phone went
Yes, I understand. I'm just kidding. And so the Russians gave him a piece of crash saucer that they had gotten over time. And then when he visited China, he went all the way around the world for Senator Pell. The Chinese gave him, they traded him a piece of crash saucer that they had for a piece of the Russian crash saucer. So he came through with a small briefcase full of some real treasures and met tremendous number of really exceptional people in the UFO field specifically in his travels around the world, in India, China, Russia, and a number of other countries. So anyway, then he went to work for, and I tell you these things because they are important to the overall topic. Then he went to work for Lawrence Rockefeller when Lawrence Rockefeller was going up to the White House to pressure the Clinton administration to do disclosure. Didn't work, but he was, you know, CB was right in the middle of that. And anyway, the two of us now have formed a think tank called Cosmic Humanity, and you can see it on the web, cosmichumanity.org. And one of the pieces that I wrote that is posted on cosmichumanity.org is called An Open Letter to Pope Francis. Because what we did as a first project, as a think tank, am I running over on my...
No, keep talking. I'll be listening forever.
Well, I guess what we could do is just quickly just get everybody introduced, and then I definitely want to hear more about the open letter to Pope Francis and the think tank. So
when I realize you're conveying stuff directly from Enki and doing his... service, it's just like I'm just it's electric. I want to hear more of that, you know.
So how about this? Let me just introduce our other guest,
sure,
Alex, and then I do want to hear more about this. Okay, just one moment. I don't want to be rude to our other people. One second, I gotta get the right number here. Where is he? Okay. One second. So welcome to our show, Alex Teplish. Would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and your research and what you're doing in regards to the Anunnaki research?
Hi, thank you for having me. This is Alex Teplish.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Janet. Thank you, Dr. Sasha Lesson. And it's great to meet you, Neil. I've actually read your book as well, Breaking the God Spell, and have read majority of Zechariah Sitchin's books and attended his lecture in New York over a decade ago.
Okay.
let's
somebody sneezing. Okay.
So I'm probably the youngest of the group. I actually immigrated with my family to the United States from the former USSR back in the late 70s when I was 2 years old. And I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, come from a Jewish background, although we've never been observant, just follow some traditions and, you know, all about the family. But as a young child, I did attend a Jewish school called Yeshiva. And a lot of these biblical stories that both all three of the major religions, the Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, talk about many of these stories, fascinated me as a child. I always wondered what really went on. These stories were so grand that people kept them up and wrote them down and spoke about them for thousands of years. Fast forward a little bit into the future. When the internet first came around, throughout my childhood, I always had a fascination with sci-fi and extraterrestrials, and I began to research And that's when I discovered Zechariah Sitchin's books, as well as many others. So that brought me into the subject of the Anunnaki, how they tied to the Sumerian civilization, and all the parallels between the biblical stories to the Sumerian stories, which were really the first civilization known to man that read their civilization, their history, and how and their day-by-day life. So that that fascination with this subject, I read many of these books, which were nonfiction, which were full of information and detail, and they read like textbooks. They were very interesting, packed with information, and I would lend them out to some friends, and some friends would see them as fascinating, but some others wouldn't necessarily have the time to get into all the details. So I thought of the idea that we needed to put something together that was more visual, to give people an idea of how this story may have taken place, not all the details and all the connections to the Sumerians and everything else, but how such a story may have taken place. So I actually originally wrote it as a screenplay, and the goal is to eventually put together a movie or a series about this. But I adapted it into a graphic novel format. And that's my that's basically the book I recently came out with. It's a graphic novel that it features Zechariah Sitchin as one of the characters making a discovery that takes us back 400,000 years into the past when the Anunnaki journey from Nibiru to Earth, create mankind, and interact with humanity's genesis. So that's basically
what's the name
project.
Of the book called? Same the book again?
The book is called In the Beginning, The Epic of the Anunnaki. You could check it out on my website, inthebeginningthebook.com. And I also researched the subject and put a lot of my research onto Facebook. We have a Facebook page for the book, and that's where I feature a lot of related topics and research there. And I also do talks like this on radio shows and go further into the subject of the Anunnaki.
Well, thank you so much. And I guess I'll just tell a little bit, and then we're going to go back to some questions. Are you finished? Or do you have anything else you wanted to add?
I'll have plenty to add later.
Okay, yeah, we'll do round two, yeah. Well, I just really briefly, I'm an experiencer contactee. I've had contact since the moment I was born back in the crib, and I kind of kept it to myself because it wasn't real popular to be talking about it, and couldn't talk about it with my parents and any of my friends. And so finally I met Dr. Lesson in the late 97. And he's a psychotherapist. So we started doing hypnosis on all these episodes that I've had. And so I have a whole book I'm telling about my contact. But Neil, I've had contact with the Anunnaki since the beginning of my life as well. And I think that I've been kind of hidden from, you know, some of the dark elements. And so that led me to starting out in the 60s. I'm 60 years old now, so back in the mid to late 60s, we had Eric von Daniken and Balakowski, and I started studying all these things at a very young age, like you. I was 12, 13. I was a Star Trek fan, and then I found Zechariah Sitchin, and Dr. Liss and I were so fortunate because our best friends were running the Prophets Conference, and they had sponsored Zechariah for his first certification program. So we were in that from the beginning, and we studied with him until he died. But then we discovered all these wonderful people like Neil. And now we're doing a radio show, and I'm so happy that all of you have joined us today for this roundtable discussion. So I'm going to just open all the mics, so just be aware of background noise because you're all going to be live now. So if you got to make noise, mute your own mic on your end. All right. So, Dr. Lesson, would you, make sure he's unmuted. Okay. Would you like to ask the first question for the group, or do you want to go back and let Neil finish his?
I want to let Neil finish.
Okay. Neil, take it away.
Alex, I want to say that it's a real pleasure to meet you. And this is a really extraordinary kind of event here we've got, where logically Anunnaki contactees and scholars are coming together, and we can do it on a pretty comfortable basis, so without people, you know, throwing rocks or innuendos at us. Let's see, there was a couple of things that you mentioned that I wanted to respond to that are sort of aside of the subject. And that is that I wrote a screenplay. I have it in the folder. And it is about Zechariah Sitchin. It's called The Babel Factor. And it's about a really bright archaeology major, a lady professor, and so on. We ought to trade back and forth and see if we can we could do a production together. Anyway,
yay!
We could even do readings of the script from different locales on a program. As a way of warming up to it.
Yeah.
All right. Like they say in Santa Fe Spanish here, way cool.
Oh, I just wanted to say we have also Robert Evans here. You missed his introduction. So there's, I can't count how many of us are here. There's Robert, Alex, Neil, and then John's kind of listening at the end. He can ask some questions. All right. We have a full house here. John is
South.
John, I should have him say hi. He's from Ohio, and he's a researcher. And so let me just, Neil, you continue. I'll pull him on later. This is my first juggling act with so many people in the queue that I want to have speak. So.
Okay.
Go ahead. You continue for a while.
An author who has not been mentioned by any of us yet, but whom I think should have gotten a Nobel Prize, just like Zechariah Sitchin should have, is Sir Lawrence Gardner. If anybody hasn't seen his work, starting with Bloodline of the Holy Grail, Genesis of the Grail Kings, and so on, there's five or six books, I think, or seven. He met kind of an untimely death that I was very uncomfortable with maybe 2 years ago. Zechariah,
I think he died within days of Zechariah Sitchin in October 2010. It was shocking. We lost two back-to-back.
Yeah, right. It bothered the bloody hell out of me, quite frankly, because I was suspicious of the whole thing. Anyway, though he takes off where Zechariah leaves off, and his work on the Grail bloodline is directly pertinent to our discussions if we're going to talk about Jesus or which Jesus is the real one and so on. I think puts the vast commentary that I wanted to put out there aside, and so where would you like to go with the discussion?
One thing is about the bloodline comes to for me to the very heart of things, which is a hierarchic one-upsmanship attitude, which is keeps us divided and pitted against each other, that was inherent in Anunnaki society, or in Nibiran society before they ever got here, and which was demonstrated to be lethal to us and to them. And they'll murder everybody and anybody and pit us against each other and never let us really feel our oneness with each other. And I think this is critical. And I think the idea of bloodlines is racism, and I think it's what stifles the light of so many of us, and especially women on this planet, is my humble opinion.
Well, so let's say, since this is Good Friday and we're going to have Easter, we're actually going to continue this conversation on Revolution Radio on Sunday. I don't know if we'll continue, but we're going to talk more about it. Let us talk about the Anunnaki and religion. And I've got the mics open for Alex and Robert and Neil and me and Sash. Who wants to kind of go first? What are your insights on what's going on here with the Anunnaki and the creation of religion? Or
well, I suppose since I wrote Breaking the Godspell and so on, let me have a shot at it first.
Okay.
In fact, and it is a total surprise to me, Dr. Lesson, that your opinion of the bloodline is such, because I have just the opposite historical perspective and understanding of it. So let me put out a little bit of the religion thing. Let's see. Okay. First of all, what I think that most people should know at the very beginning, if they're interested in changing their paradigm, is that the Bible and Genesis, the first book of the Bible, are simply theopolitically skewed rewrites of the original 3,000-year-older precise Sumerian histories. And so when Sitchin, puts all this out as, okay, they were not supernatural gods. They were humanoid. They were real. They were flesh and blood, and they were alien. And puts out that thesis, and then it gave me the opportunity to work out the ramifications of that, and that is that if you jump 3,000 years ahead at the time of Jesus, you find that there were two Jesuses. One, I better not get too far, too fast.
we can get to the two Jesuses down the line, okay.
Yeah, that religion, as we know it, the God-fearing religions, Christian, Catholic, Hebrew, Muslim, whatever, those are simply sublimations, transmutations, sublimations of the ancient master-slave relationship. And if Gardner is correct, then Jehovah Yahweh is Enlil, one of the brothers who ran this planet as for the Anunnaki, and Adonai the Lord is Enki, his brother. Now, I think those two brothers and their attitudes and towards humans give us the keys to the understanding of our history and the nature of the bloodline. Because if, again, Gardner is correct, he says that if you go all the way back to the original Hebrew texts, not the current modern translations and so on, but the Hebrew text, you find that things are said like, it does not say that Cain was a bad guy who slew his brother. It doesn't say that at all. The original Hebrew texts say that Cain was superior to Abel. And Gardner says that his research, as honestly and meticulously as he could do it, shows that the second story of Eve in the book of Genesis, where in modern terms Eve goes to Adam and says, "Hey man, I got a kid from the Lord," and instead of being pissed off that she's out going around, he says, "Way cool." That's wow. and so Gardner says that when you really investigate that story in depth in the ancient records, you find that what Enki did knowing that they, the Anunnaki, were going to phase back, at least, if not off planet, in quite a bit of time, but still they worked in large segments of time as we know it, that he selected this human female, Eve, in the second story of Adam and Eve, and fathered the child by her. And the father, and the child's name was Cain, from which comes Cain, kinship, kingship. And in order to put, to create this line of kings deliberately, who would take their place in charge of the of human beings, hopefully. And as kings, they were trained by Enki, who was empathic and sympathetic towards humans, to be servants of the people. That was a major factor. And so here comes Cain as the first one in the line of this kingship line, the bloodline, the Graal special bloodline, which eventually ended up to be Grail, Holy Grail, and so on. And so what happened was that that line came all the way through from Sumeria, at least, if not a little bit before Sumeria, through the Egyptian, through most of the Egyptian rulers, and then it ended up in the Essene community, which was way out in the desert, the Jewish community, the Essene community, and Jesus and Mary, his wife, she was royalty also, and the concept of royalty comes from the bloodline, and she and he were both Essenes, and when it was time for him to come forward, of course, we now have to deal with the other side of the Anunnaki mentality, in that Enlil was of not empathic with humans. He said many times to us, you know, you were created as a slave species. Keep your place, keep your mouth shut, and just do your jobs. You know, we don't want to have any part of this. Whereas Enki was not completely just the opposite, but much farther over that way. And so that gives us the clues to the religious lines that have come up to us, the two major traditions that have come up through Western culture particularly and the rest of the world. The Enlilite, those who emulated Enlil, eventually ended up doing the male chauvinist trip. They didn't have the bloodline. They became the bishops gradually of the Jewish Christianity, and so on. And then Enki's emulators in the bloodline eventually went into the woodwork because they were persecuted and many times killed. And that was what the Inquisition was about. Now, when I was in Catholic school, I was taught that the Inquisition was weeding out heretics, which were evil Christian or whatever. But it wasn't so at all. It was the bloodline that Enlil's emulators and followers, in other words, the Roman Catholic Church, but specifically as it formed and so on, ran the Inquisition like Innocent the First, Pope Innocent the First of the Catholic Church, knew that there was a bloodline community in southern France. Name of the town is slipping me right off, but he sent an army in there and killed thousands of them. He even impaled their seminarians on stakes. So this was what the real history of the heterodox, heretical, sorry.
Enki's bloodline,
Enki's group, the bloodline. And that bloodline has come all the way up through to us, and I have met the current end product of that bloodline, the Prince, what's his name, in Scotland. And it's interesting that they didn't have the bloodline. And once, and so there is this exceptional book that was written after the death of the princess, Princess Diana.
Oh, Princess Diana, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And when after she was dead.
She was of the bloodline? I heard that she was of the bloodline.
She had the bloodline double. She had it through the real Jesus. And I say the real Jesus because the synthetic Jesus that was concocted by the Catholic Church under orders of the Pope in 365 at that conference, you know, where they had fist fights and everything determining all this stuff. That Jesus of the New Testament, as it's written, is a synthetic character who isn't real at all. So the real Jesus is the one in the bloodline. And so to jump way forward, at the time that Princess Diana and Charles were born, their grandmothers got together because they knew that Charles' side of the family had no bloodline at all, and they wanted it. So what they did is they determined together that when Diana and Charles would grow up, they would marry and they would have children because they knew that Diana, through the genealogies, had the bloodline twice, both through the real Jesus and his brother James. And so that's what happened. And then she took up with, I think there was little love lost between the two of them, but they did what they were supposed to do and had children. And now the bloodline is in the British family again, or for the first time, I guess. And so she started to take up with Jody Fayed, and as far as they can tell, or I could tell from the stuff that was written by this journalist that wrote the book about her, called Princess Diana, The Hidden Evidence, she was pregnant with his child, and he had just bought her a $200,000 engagement ring or something of the day that she was pretty much obviously murdered. They were all murdered in that car accident. She was apparently not dead at the end of the accident, and so the people that picked her up took her past the hospital the big hospital that she should have been taken to immediately, and to some Cobb House little place that hospital where they sat for an hour waiting probably for her to die and maybe also to take the fetus. But anyway,
I think that he's made a real convincing case for what the bloodline is, but what I'm saying is that when the Windsors are billionaires and people are starving, that's what I mean about the unfairness or the how having bloodlines determine who should be the boss is contrary to us finding our own destiny and using the brilliance of all of our earthlings.
Oh, I would totally agree in that. I think that the Windsors, I think that they wanted the bloodline, but I don't think that the notion, any of the training and a philosophy that Enki had instilled in the original bloodline kings, you know, servants of the people and so on. I don't think that that took into the Windsors at all. They just wanted it in their genealogy, and that was it. I would totally agree that, you know, if they were truly understanding of the role that the bloodline was supposed to play, then maybe they would do something, but obviously
what was the original concept? Enki was creating this kingship for a good purpose, right? For continuing civilization and guidance. I read part of it, but can you tell us?
Right.
I haven't read through Gardner's books, and I just ordered about three of them, but if you could kind of, since you've obviously mastered this material and he's no longer with us, if you could maybe fill in the blanks. So what was the purpose of this bloodline from Enki's perspective?
Well, Enki was a teacher from the beginning. You know, well, he was the major scientist who did the genetic engineering in the laboratory in East Central Africa to bring us about as a new species, and he was always teaching us and treating us well and bringing us along. And in fact, I think he was really surprised at how fast we did begin to evolve. So he wanted somebody, when he said servants of the people, he wanted somebody who would do just the same thing to humans, for humans, as he was doing. And he even taught them in special schools. We call them mystery schools now, but they weren't mystery schools at all. He was teaching them advanced science, mathematics and medicine and so on and so on. You know, if you go back into the records, you can see that there was a great deal of this stuff going on. Whereas Enlil's brother could care less. He just wanted, you know, slaves to take care of him, and dig gold in the gold mine. And I think it was Enki also who introduced us to white powder gold, monatomic gold, which is the single atom of gold that you ingest. I'm ingesting it, for longevity. So, in other words, all good things, positive things for humans were what Enki wanted and did, and he wanted the fullness of that to be passed on in the training and education of these particular Grail kings.
All right. Let's hear from Robert. Okay, you want to stop? Yeah, Robert's scraping me. You want to go next, Robert?
Sure. It's an honor to be on the show with you, Neil. I watched one of your videos the other day, and I was really interested. I'm just curious, with the knowledge you have you ever seen the Ahura Mazda wall carvings over in Iran, Middle East?
Let's see.
They kind of look like a huge pair of bird's wings with, I think, on the Enki standing right in the middle of them.
Oh, in this, sorry. Okay, he's he's facing to his right, and there is a circle around his body.
Yes.
That the wings are attached to, yeah. And that is Sitchin's interpretation of that is that it's a symbol of Nibiru, of the 10th planet itself.
Okay.
You know, as, yeah.
Okay.
What's behind your question, Robert? That's what you're seeing around the sun?
Yes. Neil, do you realize that those ships are actually coming into our system on a daily basis, and NASA has been recording them since 1998? The Anunnaki are here.
I have not been following that. And I'm embarrassed to say that I don't know much about that. I've heard about ships coming into our system, and there is so much other stuff that I've been paying attention to that tell me gently or generally about it and how they are making themselves known.
The evidence, you have some really good evidence, Robert.
Yes. These are all from the SOHO satellite cameras, stereo ahead, stereo behind cameras. I have one excellent.
They're focused on the sun, right?
Yes. They for a long time they came past our sun, but then in 2011 they actually started to come out of warp or whatever you want to call it. On this side of the sun, where the cameras actually caught them jumping out of what they were, some type of light speed drive. I'm sorry, Neil. Happy birthday.
Oh. Thank you.
I was on your webpage and I sent you a friendship also, and I realized you only have, I think, two friends on there. I'm not sure if you'll.
I don't think Neil's on Facebook very much. But anyway,
no, I don't do it.
So Robert has some photos that he's going to give to me, or he has given to me, and I have it up on Aquarian Radio website, and I'll stick one at the bottom of this episode. So, okay, so what's your findings or research? I mean, Neil's obviously this expert on the ancient through the modern with the connections with Jesus, and we're going to get back to that. But what do you have to contribute with what do you know about the period after, you know, who's Jesus and what's this religion stuff that we're all paying attention to? The planet's paying attention to it this week, and we got Easter, and we got Good Friday and Easter. So why are we doing this from your perspective?
Well, the Easter, the Passover, the Hebrews leaving Egypt fell right under the last time Nibiru, the planet, was in our system, roughly around 1556 BC. You have the ancient Bible version saying that Moses pulled them out of Egypt, and then you had the ancient scroll from Ippuwer, Ipuwer, saying that a priest, prince in the inner courtyard of Pharaoh led the slaves and evildoers out of Egypt, including a huge amount of Egyptians went with them. And it's two huge, very huge versions all saying the same thing. And Neil just kind of blew me away by, you know, his talking that they actually came to him, and he's been working with them all this time. And I've been seeing these huge UFO-type ships, and they match exactly with the Ahura Mazda wall carvings over in the Middle East. So we're right on track, exactly.
Wow.
Well, you know, it's really interesting. Zechariah basically said that after Joseph became the overseer of Egypt, he invited his father, Israel, Jacob, and his sons, including those that had sold him into slavery, back into Egypt. And over the years, they became 600,000 of these Egyptians, and another set of pharaohs started coming in. And it looked like that Marduk and Nabu were closing in on on the spaceport in the Sinai, and the way that Pharaoh looked at the Israelites then was that this is a fifth column that was going to take him down. And that's the background that Zechariah saw in Enlil getting his people and then having them brand themselves, circumcising themselves later. But anyway, that's Zechariah's story on it.
And also, Gardner's take on the Exodus is that Moses was not Moses. It was not his name. He was a Mose, and a very important person, and he actually was Akhenaten, the Egyptian ruler.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, what's with the big heads? Did the Anunnaki have big heads like Akhenaten?
I don't see that in the carvings and so on.
No.
You're talking about the elongated head. No.
I
don't see that in the Egyptian.
But Akhenaten had a large head, and Nefertiti, his wife, did. So we're trying to figure out that piece. Was that some kind of other alien race that came in? Now they're finding all these skulls, and they're calling them Homo capensis, and it's like, what is this stuff coming in here?
Well, there's even a carving of it in Pumapunku, right in the wall, sort of showing all the different kinds of contexts. It seems like throughout history there's been not just the Anunnaki, but many different visitors, beings from other dimensions, perhaps, or that have been visiting Earth. And Zachariah has gotten part of the story, but we've interviewed so many people, really reliable witnesses, and we are utterly convinced that there's been succession of an ongoing visitation by these beings.
Neil, so who were the Greys that visited you with probably Enki, the Anunnaki?
Oh, they were employees.
They're employees.
Anunnaki employees, because I was picked up in a blue cloud field from a sound sleep in the middle of the night. What time, I have no idea. By four little Greys, the short little type, and they were having a ball. It was almost like they were apprentices learning the trade, and they wanted me to be happy and have fun with them, and they were holding me up horizontal, weightless. And the sergeant was standing in back of my head, and he was the one who was guiding the conversation. It was interesting. He wanted me to say when I woke up, not be afraid, but curious. And one of the things he had me ask first was, what are you? Because you remember, this was before Roswell. This was 1942, and so I had no real perspective on this, and so when I asked, well, yeah, what are you? He said, we're androids. Well, I didn't know androids at that point, and he knew I knew it, didn't know it, and so he gave me a definition when he used the word, and he said, we're it's a combination of humanoid and robot. And he probably knew that I knew robot from reading Flash Gordon, as a kid.
Right.
And so it was a that was the introduction to them. But they were obviously servants of the of the Anunnaki themselves.
Of the Anunnaki.
Because when he asked me, when he wanted me to ask who's the who's the boss here? Whose boss is here? Who's your boss? This white curtain was pulled aside symbolically, and I got to confront this real humanoid, who I said was the one in the white robe and the big Semitic beard and so on. So yes, I would agree. The head shape thing has always been a puzzle to me, because of the fact that it was in the Egyptians, but it also showed up in the in South America.
Right.
And of course, we know that in, I think it was, Sitchin says 1331 B.C., the Anunnaki took a bunch of their experienced gold miners over to the new gold mines in South America. And so And it was Thoth, known to the Egyptians as Thoth, but Ninhursag to the Sumerians.
Ningishida.
Yes. And then he was Quetzalcoatl and so on over here. I don't see enough information to say that Ningishida or the Anunnaki in general, or Enki or anybody, you know, invented a type of human that had that elongated skull. Yes, I think we're looking at a lot of different alien influences from a long period of time.
I just wanted to interject here that I too saw the Anunnaki. They've always said they are protecting me, same thing. And in December of 96, I was on Johnson Atoll, and I was taken, carried by six grays. They had six of them carry me. They carried me kind of like a surfboard. and then they took me to the edge.
Accompanied by
six U.S. military, right? And they took me to the edge of the water. They brought down my boyfriend, and they set us down, and then they walked into a beam ship, and we went out. The beam ship launched out into the edge of the atoll, into this really deep part of if you do an aerial of Johnston Atoll, it's a very strange-looking island. Anyway, so there's a part where it's really deep, so we went underground, underwater, and they did the traditional things to my boyfriend on the metal table. And where do they manufacture those metal tables anyway? And it took me down into a ritual. I was put in. I was given a gown that formed itself to my body, and then I. Anyway, I'm not going to go into the great details, but I saw about 1,000 of them. It was just a huge cavern. I didn't count, hundreds
of
the tall Anunnaki, and I don't think they were the tall whites that Charles Hall was talking about. That sounds like a different species. For me, I definitely have always been, you know, the energy. They were the Anunnaki, and they were gorgeous, absolutely beautiful beings, you know, kind of like enhanced humans, and very tall. And then, anyway, so I agree. Back to somebody, back to you, Neil, or back to Sasha.
Well, just a very interesting thing that Clark and others have basically said, that they suggest that Jesus was really Thoth or Kuklan or Quetzalcoatl, Ningishida, the same dude. And then, of course, there's other people that said there never was a Jesus, and there's other people that said he was basically leading a revolution against the God-fearing religions so I think Courtney Brown said that it was a drunk that got crucified instead. It goes on and on. Everybody seems to have, but every story justifies the current ideological bent.
Right, but I think he was. I think Jesus was not an incarnation, but a transmigration of thought into the Jesus form, for the purpose of this creation of this agenda for the Anunnaki, the good Anunnaki, to lead humanity. It got co-opted, of course. And okay, so I won't go into that, but that's my opinion.
Yes,
I was going to say we haven't heard from Alex, but let's call Alex in to have some feedback, and then we're just going to go free flow. So don't sit back there. If you have something to say, you know, kind of interject. Okay, so Alex, let's hear from you, and then we're going to go free flow, okay?
Okay. Well, there's a lot of information we've covered so far. In my graphic novel, I actually depict Enki, Anu, Enlil, many of the other characters, Marduk. I also tie it into the stories, the story of mankind's creation with Adam and Eve, the stories of Cain and Abel, the stories of the Tower of Babel, and the story of the Flood. Basically, through my research, and I've discovered something that was called Pan-Babylonianism, which in the 19th century, way before Zechariah Sitchin, von Däniken, or any of the others came out with their books, there was already a school of thought researching Assyriology and Sumerian stories that had parallels to the Old Testament, to the book of Genesis. Many of these parallels, examples of these parallels were that in the beginning the universe was shapeless and there was nothing but water. Six generation of gods created one after the other, each associated with something such as the sky or the earth. This parallels the 6 days of creation in Genesis. Six generation of gods consult with one another and decide to make mankind as servants so that the gods can rest on the seventh day. These are parallels to the book of Genesis, and these stories come from the Atrahasis, which trace back to the Sumerians. Other parallels are the stories of Adapa, which parallel to Adam, and there are many parallels that from those stories of the similarities that they had. So another one is the flood story. In fact, the flood story is something that has been spoken about by majority of the ancient civilizations all around the world. So they have this common story of this great flood from civilizations that were supposedly had no contact with one another. So these are some of the things that I've discovered in my research. And then there's so many other parallels with ancient myths and legends from these various disconnected societies. Examples are the Vedic society from India. They talk about the various yugas, which are the cycles of the ages of mankind. And right now we're supposedly living in the fourth one, entering the fifth. Most of them talk about the previous cycle ending in a great flood. So all of these things being so connected around the world, those are the things I like to research and notice. The parallels between these things are basically, those are the truths. Everything else, or many of the other aspects of religion.
It's not just that they're disconnected and they came up with the same thing. My research seems to show that there was an interconnected global network of communication and power stations sending from pyramidal structures, receiving with monoliths and throughout the globe. And these people were connected. And the Ijiji, who had lost their job on Mars when the astronomical events that caused the deluge also messed up Mars base, they had taken wives and when they had rebelled at Marduk's wedding to Sarpanit and seized the landing platform at Baalbek. And so they were here, and Anu had ordered Enlil that he had to warn them so they could get to high ground, and a lot of them were scattered out with their earthling wives. At least that's my take on what Zacharias written.
Right,
no,
right. Well,
and,
yeah.
And, I understand that the I understand there's a very interesting book called Secrets of the Lost Races. It's probably 20 or 30 years old now. And he's tracing a great deal of these parallels, and he shows that the American Indians, for instance, had 42 versions of the flood myth, flood story, way back when we first encountered them. And there is a book called Cataclysm by Allan and Dallaire, A-L-L-A-N and Dallaire, that is a study by these two scientific minds, Britishers, of the evidence for the flood as a real thing all over the planet. Mm-hmm. And they say that when you look hard enough, you can still find that there are crevices and caverns and all kinds of places where the floodwaters, which were so powerful, coursing over the earth at that particular time, plants and animals and human beings and were just packed in there, jammed in there, and from different places on the planet too. You know, they were moved all around. And he says that the, for instance, I think it's the, one of the major Indian tribes says that their tradition, traditions of their beginnings say they climbed out of the earth. Well,
that's the Hopi.
When you go back, the Hopi.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay. And he says that when you go back and investigate that story, you realize that they were lucky enough to escape, at least some of them, into caverns and so on to protect themselves against the floods, against the major flood, and they actually had to claw their way out of the packed earth and everything, and that's what they were really talking about.
Well, you know, also, Neil, there, some of my Indian friends have told me that the gods came to them and kept saying, go higher, go higher, go higher, that they had actually been saved on purpose by Anunnaki, who wished to preserve them, contrary to the law that Enlil had put down. And so they were saved lots of places, and it was...
Is that Indian or
no,
Native American?
Native American Indians. They said, go higher, go
Native
higher,
American,
build up higher.
Yes, yeah.
Right.
Protect yourselves, yes. And then they also found that in the traditions, some of the tribes said that there were white people, and apparently meaning Anunnaki type, who came to them after the flood had receded to sort of help them build back up to, you know, some kind of a decent living. And so, yeah, the Anunnaki were totally involved. But I think we need to see now, and C.B. Scott Jones and I, in all our studies for all these years, have come to the easy conclusion that what we're seeing right now is another occasion where there could be a flood. There may not be, because it may be a mild one this time on the Earth, but it's the incoming 10th planet. It has that 3,600 huge elliptical orbit that takes it way out to form the outer edge of the solar system, and then it comes ripping in once every 3,600 years in between Mars and Jupiter, where the asteroid belt is, where it was involved in the first place in the collisional event, and so on, so on, so on. But it is now on its way in, as best we can tell. It was rediscovered in 1983 by the IRIS infrared imaging satellite, and mentioned six times in the major press. But it's been covered up because they don't. They know that.
So how far away do you think it is? I mean,
well, you know,
for when it's going to...
It's a really tough call, because Sitchin said he did it mathematically by the records, and he thinks that it would be coming in here into the inner solar system, close to the Earth, by 2068 or 2058. One of the alien species that was in contact with a friend of mine a little while ago was saying that it's still hundreds of years before it comes back in. And in between that, there are a number of people who have been, you know, trying to estimate and protect us. And I think that... Mrs. Sitchin said just before she died that she was sure that Harrington of the Naval Observatory, with whom Zechariah had that big conference in his office, and who had sent a scope down to look for it and to see it, apparently, in the southern hemisphere, because it's tipped 40 degrees below the ecliptic, she thinks he was murdered because of... They wanted to cover it up because he was vocal about it. And
Neil,
because there are three. Yes.
Excuse me. NASA actually imaged. NASA actually imaged the brown dwarf star that Nibiru is planet number six to orbits around it back in 2007, 2008. Really?
Because what made me has caused me to be very skeptical and reject the brown dwarf and failed sun theory or fact, maybe, is that what was his name? Oh God, there was the man, the scientist from NASA JPL, who was in charge of the Pioneer spacecraft.
I forget his name.
Anyway, he said,
we'll look it up.
He said that after seeing the results of the Pioneer spacecraft data, he was convinced that there wasn't any twin star to our solar system at all, but there was a large body planet, in other words, a tenth planet that was extant. So I don't know. I know that there have been people who have been putting that brown dwarf theory out. And there was also a statement made by NASA, maybe the NSA or somebody who was monitoring, said they were monitoring the NASA data, that there was a brown dwarf. I still am very skeptical about that one. I think
it's
on its own.
Robert, tell us what's behind your theory. We'll just call it all a theory for now. You have some photos? Are you there,
yes.
Bob? Okay.
Yes.
What's behind your theory on that? Do you have photos or something? We'll have to put them out there, but go ahead. Say.
Yes. I have the leaked information from NASA showing an infrared image showing the brown dwarf and its five inner planets. I also have microwave images directly of Nibiru itself. I also have a DSS, that's a standard-type image when you look through a telescope, showing the five inner planets orbiting around nothing because a brown dwarf cannot be seen in a DSS image. I have all this stuff. It's been out for a while now, and no one's really been paying attention to it. I also have a PowerPoint slide that was made from leaked NASA information in 2009 showing the two systems interacting. And as of December 21st, 2012, they were showing that Nibiru was about 20 AUs from going through our system. That's still a decent amount of distance, but this is all the stuff I have.
Well, it creates sunspot activity that you recorded, right?
It would normally, because of the interaction between the main sun and its primary binary type thing, but the aliens are intervening. They're, with their huge space probes they've been seeing all around our sun for over 6 years, they're quieting our sun. That's why you're not having all these huge solar storms that NASA had predicted for December 21st, 2012. They're not there. And that's because of those huge alien space probes all around our sun.
And these ships are the size of planets, aren't they? Some of them are that large.
They are, yes. If I can mention third phase of the moon, I did two videos with them. One was specifically about these solar things around our sun, and they're clearly being shown. So they're intervening so we don't have the same problem as we did during the Exodus back in 1558,
I believe. 56, you said, B.C. So if we just did the math, and it's 3,600 years, who could do the math? What year would that be coming back? But, of course, every time there's interaction between the two different solar systems, or you know, the planets and the sun and the brown dwarf and their planets and moons. Doesn't it adjust each time because it changes because of the gravitational effect and pulls?
Well, what Zachariah said is that the pass through that caused the Mars base to be closed down and the Great Deluge also had an interaction with Uranus, which sped the orbit of Nibiru through our solar system to 3,450 years, and so it changed the mathematics of it. And I want to say also that this event, the Great Deluge, was very, very critical in many ways in for the rumors that, you know, and the facts that Socrates talked about, this Atlantean civilization. This is, again, the point that this was not a bunch of isolated civilizations, but it was these people that had this advanced technology, and they had spread their grid over the entire planet, and that was destroyed, and so was the connection between Mars, yes, on which there was a base, and Earth, the pharaonic Egypt and Mars were connected in this great disaster. This near extinction event broke that and broke it down for a while.
And that one book you mentioned, Cataclysm, a compelling evidence of a cosmic catastrophe in 9500 BC. I've read that book, and it is just amazing with the amount of research the two gentlemen, D.S. Allen and J.B. DeLayer, came up with. Just fantastic.
Yeah, so that book really impressed me.
Yeah, I was trying to get it. I think it's out of publication. Yeah, but go ahead.
Well, there's... It sounds like it's off topic, but it isn't off topic. There is a website called thelibertyman.com or thelibertyman.org, maybe. And it is run by a man by the name of John Moore, who was military intelligence, and who has kept in touch with his friends in the intelligence community ever since. And he says that he even had a copy of Sitchin's book posted on his website. And he says that he has been told repeatedly by his intelligence friends that the Navy now, the Navy is telling their retirees, don't even think about retiring anywhere as close to any of the coasts. Get at least 800 feet up in altitude, and maybe even in the mountains in the Midwest.
Yes.
Because what can happen is not only will this cause general flooding, but let's say the 10th planet comes ripping in through the solar system, I don't know where the other four planets will go at that time, but it will, if it comes close to the Earth, he says that, and it's supposed to be Uranus size, that it can retard the spin of the Earth really substantially. And he said anybody that retards the spin of the Earth counteracts that centrifugal spin, which normally keeps miles of water build up around the equator.
Mm-hmm.
And if you retard it for even a day, he said miles of water will release, and Florida could be underwater in a day. And they know, he says, that they know about the 10th planet. Now, NASA can put out some patsy scientists, so-called scientists and investigator, who you can see on YouTube saying, oh, no, there is no such thing as the 10th planet, and it's all nonsense, and so on, so on, so on. And, you know, at the same time, somebody is releasing, you know, trickling out stuff from the inside.
Yes.
So, anyway, I thought that announcement by the Navy, you know, would be kind of significant, because they don't have anything involved except protecting their people.
Exactly.
Right.
Have you ever heard about the book, The Colbrin Bible?
Yes, I have. I may have a copy on the shelf here. Yeah.
Okay. I have the hardback version. In there, there's a version that matches Enki's telling someone through a reed wall how to build the ark and how they built it. And in the description, they mention in there that when the flood hit, there was a time of cold and a time of hot, which matches exactly what the two authors put in their book. So that's almost exactly what happened before.
Yeah, like a mini ice age and stuff.
Yes.
It makes the storms, huge, huge storms.
So does this happen every time Nibiru comes through?
No.
It would, you know, we've had the Noah's flood of, what was it, 9,500 B.C., but, you know, we've had another passing or two, right? Am I doing the math right? Every time it comes through, it doesn't do major things, or does it?
Yeah, well, as far as I can tell, it is... It's best to look at as a 12-body problem in physics. Being able to work out the relative position of three moving bodies relative to each other was not really feasible until they got huge computers to do it. Now we have a 12-body problem in the sense of all the major planets being affected by the incoming 10th planet. And so as far as the Earth is concerned, and you can see Mars has been devastated how many times? Who knows?
Yes.
And, if anybody's living up there, they're living underground. But with the Earth... If the Earth is on the opposite side of the Sun, or the other side of the Sun, when this Uranus-sized planet comes ripping through, we probably have mild ones. And hopefully, if the Anunnaki spacecraft, planet-sized, are modifying the Sun, maybe they're trying to modify the conditions so that when the planet comes in the next time, it will be a mild one.
Yes.
Because we really don't need to be shaken up every 3,500 years, to the extent of almost annihilation.
No.
And so...
yeah, we have enough
problems. definitely enough problems.
And
I think that's the way to see it.
And Dr. Harrington was correct about the ecliptic angle for the Nibirian system compared to our system. It's just about right on.
Yeah. Well, I think when he sent a scope and a team down, and as I understand it, they got a visual from the southern hemisphere, and then he put his own 8-inch pocket scope in his pocket and went down there to have a direct look himself, and that's when, well. Mrs. Sitchin says he was wasted before he ever got back.
Yes.
Yeah, I didn't know how he died.
To write to write his reports.
Right.
The
other thing is, wouldn't it be more than more than 12 planets if Nibiru has, what did you say, 5 or 6 planets? Then you would have, 18 planets.
Yeah,
right.
Six planets. In the brown dwarf system, Pluto has the exact same inclination as Nibiru does, but we consider it in our system. It also rotates clockwise, where everything in our system rotates counterclockwise. So
I'm not sure I agree with you with the tip, the comparison there, because I think that Pluto is 15 degrees, whereas Nibiru is like 35 to 40.
Yes.
But it has the same type of and I think all these things that come ripping in as asteroids and meteorites and everything else are a whole bunch of space junk that, are in the same basic kind of orbit.
Yeah, what's that?
It's called the Lagrange points that stayed 90 degrees and 180 degrees from the primary planet at all times, and the forces of gravity and rotation keep their distance, and so that it's not just when Nibiru passes through, it's also when this 180-degree Lagrange point passes through, which is what some astronomers think is happening right now. That means all kinds of asteroid bits, it passes through something called the Kuiper gap, asteroid bits and comets, which are a bunch of big snowballs come through, and they can do a hell of a lot of damage, and they periodically have. And it's not just Nibiru, but it's this crap that's in its ecliptic.
Exactly, exactly. You can, and when you see the face of the small moons and some of the planets and everything with the craters and everything, you know, there's a lot of ammunition out there.
Mm-hmm.
And it knocks out pieces of the other planets, too. One of the interesting things was when Earth was formed, big chunks of Mercury, which had gold, hit Earth. Go ahead.
Who wanted to talk?
I just wanted to contribute to some of the things we said. This is Alex speaking, actually.
Hi, Alex.
We mentioned the Hopis earlier, and they also have the same concept of the cycles of Earth. And they also say that we're in the fourth cycle, the fourth age of humanity, which is a complete parallel to the Vedics. Touching on what Dr. Sasha Lessen said earlier about world communication, I think we're in agreement that in the previous age, that the world was a lot more advanced and was in communication with one another. And it's basically since the last cycle ended and the new one began after the flood is when the world kind of got rebooted and started all over again and went back to living in very primitive ways and confused their ancient history and basically turned them into a combination of their spiritual pursuits with this ancient history that was not really understood. So that's when all these disconnected ancient remnants of those civilizations were spread around the earth and had lost knowledge of one another. But they had similar stories and similar beliefs that they trace back to these different, to the same origin story. We also mentioned that Ahura Mazda carving, there's parallels to the sun disk in ancient Egypt and the wing disk in Sumerians, with the Sumerians, and even the ancient Hebrews, when they used a similar wing disk as symbols for their kings in the early stages of the ancient Hebrews. So these are all the different parallels that they do trace back to this previous cycle, previous age of humanity, which has been rebooted several times. Also, going back to what we said about the Anunnaki, I think that they're not much different than we are as humans. We have different personalities, different types of leaders around the world. Some are malicious, some may be trying to do some good. And I think that, you know, in my book, I also kind of visualize them as having different personalities. Enki was more of a person who wanted to help the humans, while Enlil may have not considered that at first. I think that their initial reason for creating humanity wasn't to create us, but was more to create a docile being, similar to the way we used farm animals to help us with labor. I think that was their initial intent. They weren't trying to create an advanced rival to themselves, but when they realized that they created that, they had to let them go. They had to let them evolve on their own, but kind of still have an influence over them.
I'd like to just jump in here and say that my analysis, after looking at it for a really long time, shows me that Enki, through his son Marduk, who he promised could have been the ruler of Nibiru, made an alliance with the Earthlings and basically was trying to get Earthlings free of control by the Anunnaki, and that it was part of the get-go to raise a plan of Enki to actually create a race of Earthlings, and he got more and more into it, that would help his son Marduk challenge the line of Anu that had usurped the deal he had made with Alalu, that the child he had with Damkina, Alalu's daughter, Marduk, would be the successor to Alalu as king of Nibiru, but instead Anu overthrew him.
And I wanted to just interject in here, and we have just a little bit under half hour left, And I want to bring this into the modern times. Like, what's this all mean to today? Who is here? Who's on top of this pyramid running the show? I'd like to hear a little bit from all of you what you think about what's going on now. Who's here? Who left? Neil, would you like to go first?
Here.
Okay, who's speaking?
Okay, I'll go first. This some of it, this is a real puzzle because before he died, fairly recently, I was working with the material and talking to the fellow by the name of Borden, A.R. Borden. And he says that the book, you can download it off the web, I think, still, the first nine chapters of it, it's called The Link. He says that he was part of a small group of humans that joined once a year with other small groups of humans from other parts of the world, and they all got together and they met with alien representatives of a number of alien civilizations. The Anunnaki were part of that, and there were and so in part of that, he says that and I've heard other people say that some of the Anunnaki never left, that they are here, they are behind the scenes. Some of them say they are living in some part of way off in Tibet, some of them say, and one of them who was in contact with a contactee just recently said that yes, we have representatives in just about every government facility and government in the world and in important places. So I don't know. As far as I'm concerned, it is all up in the air. I have no way of vetting it, of proving it, but I wouldn't be surprised that they are exerting influence, and some of them are exerting really heavy influence to try to direct us, and other ones are just trying to help us evolve. I'd like to think that they're all benign, and that they have evolved over a few thousand years now to the point where they are beyond the nasty stage, and that we are at a point where they were several thousand years ago, because we're still fighting with each other and doing the whole God's fell. You know, our God is better than your God, we might have to kill you if you don't subscribe.
Sure.
That kind of silly thing. And so,
if they would just let us know that this is all real and this is our past, the religions would fall because they're all based on this artificial worship of the gods, and it's just these Anunnaki.
Well, it's still based on a murderous mafia that runs things from the top. They kill people.
And I don't think that those are Anunnaki at all. I think that they're just humans who have gotten really good at it. And I think that also just popped into my head that Lawrence Gardner says that when you trace the etymology of the word worship, you find that it was up until fairly recently with the Old English, the word was not worship. It was workship.
You know, the one thing I want to
And who's this speaking?
It's Bob.
Bob.
I want to point out that these ships, these enormous ships, these things, they're about the size of our planet, okay? These things are actually firing on something else that comes into our system. NASA has caught, I must have at least 100 satellite photographs showing these things actually targeting something and firing immense beams and actually hitting something that our cameras cannot pick up. So they're defending our system. There's no way around that. Just looking at the images I have.
Is it they are firing in a warlike manner, or is
yes.
it that they are using those beams to adjust
like
gravity?
These beams are being emitted from these massive ships in different directions, in some cases two or three beams coming out different directions as if they're being attacked or they're fighting off against someone or somebody.
Another alternative way of looking at the same thing from some of Christopher Dunn's thing is they could, as Neil suggested, be me transmitting energy waves to some other place which is picking it up and using it rather than destroying something. Is that right, Neil?
It's possible, but the military person I showed them to, he was very clear that these beams were immense. When they looked at the images, they said that these beams went right off their scales.
Wow.
Right, but you don't know where they were heading. It doesn't show another craft being hit. It could be going somewhere
else.
Yes, it does. Okay.
The images actually see the beams either missing or they're actually hitting a sphere-type-looking thing, and maybe it's like a ship with a cloaking device where our cameras cannot see exactly what it was. But
wow.
Yes.
Maybe we can't always just assume it's a negative warlike action. It could have been beaming the energy to feed the other ship. We have this way of looking through the eye because of war and violence. But I am hoping, and I keep holding this vision that they are beyond this right now. They have evolved, and hopefully, maybe they're just sending some energy to the next ship down the line that needs to be recharged.
I would like to agree with you. I'm just mm-hmm. looking directly at the images and trying to deduce what they are showing. If Neil wants to go to my webpage, he can see 19 of these images on there, different types.
What's your webpage for the listeners?
Yes, it's Starships, all one word, starshipsaroundthesun.com.
Okay, we have one listener who's been on hold for a long time, and I'm going to ask him if he has a question for our speakers tonight, Debbie. Hello, listener. Is this John, and do you have a question or something to contribute? We only have a few minutes, but go ahead.
Well, hi. My name is John. I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio. And what I'd like to ask them is that do you think that the Anunnaki or other races are cataloging the genetic structure and migration of human beings?
I would say there's no question about it.
Sure.
Well, I say this because from what I've seen, it was some patterns, the flight patterns of black triangles, that it looks like as though they were looking for something. And in the trail of it, quite a few people have been abducted, and they've been saying they've been taking blood samples and skin samples. And
I would guess, and only guess at this particular point, but strongly guess that any of that stuff that is being done at this particular point in time is being done by us, by other groups of human beings or military or sciences or somebody, because for instance, the Anunnaki, since they invented us genetically by splicing their genes with Homo erectus or whatever humanoid they used, they would have all the knowledge they needed as far as the genetics are concerned, and if they wanted to do genetic engineering again to make other types of creatures or whatever, they wouldn't have to be taking samples, I think, or doing any of the stuff that the kind of nasty things that you're mentioning, which most of us, you know, are pretty aware of. I think that that other species would also be, if they're advanced enough to be able to travel here in space and do that level of science, I should think their concept of genetics and stuff would make it easy for them, and they wouldn't have to be doing the dirty work that way.
I'm in contact with someone in Minnesota that claims that she's being regularly abducted, and samples of DNA and blood, and of course stem cells are being taken from her constantly from other beings, insectoids, reptilians on occasion. She sees hybrids, both reptilian hybrids and insectoid hybrids. And,
okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I've heard several people, John, say that there's been breeding experiments, and they're not so much about the anything except perhaps some people are saying that the Greys are trying to make a hybrid race that can survive on Earth, and that they're a dying race and stuff like that. So I've heard these things, and I've also heard from Barbara Lamb and other people that abductees or contactees talk about having wombs put in them for a while and then taken out, and then they're brought aboard ship to nurse the babies and give them some kind of human contact, and there's even colonies of hybrids and protected places on Earth, according to some of our informants.
Yeah, and that's the weird thing. If we go from the ancient, the Anunnaki, through the modern, it just gets more and more bizarre with all these stories of interactions with these different species. So I wonder if this contact has been going on all along, or somehow the Anunnaki have lost control and now we're being, you know, visited by everybody in the modern era. Any feedback on that from anybody?
How about John from Cincinnati, who was asking that question in the first place? What are your sources, John?
He's part of MUFON, right, John?
Yes, I am. I'm a certified MUFON investigator.
Oh, okay. You know, I spoke for MUFON a while back.
Yeah. So this was one of your cases that's reported to you and you've been investigating.
She contacted me, actually. She'd been online, and I knew something of her for a while, and then she contacted me over February of last year, and we've been talking about these things ever since.
I find at the experiencers groups, at the conferences, they have these huge experiencers group with about 80 people that show up and they talk about their stories. And it seems that the type of contacts where they were doing this hybrid program have lessened over time. And it's more of the old ancient Adamski and Billy Meyer early years contactee experience where they're being seen more as equals and not just some biological experiment. There's a shift in the contact, so it's surprising that this person is still having is she still having those type of episodes to this day, or is it something each happened? Okay, so we were
pretty
hoping that
heard.
The hybrid program was over.
No, it's
so.
Not over. In fact, from what I'm hearing, it's actually kicking into high gear. Much higher gear. In fact,
Since you're a researcher and you're in touch, talking with the other, what is the reason behind this hybrid program? You know, are they creating another species? Are they terraforming the planet? We have Fukushima raging out of control. We have chemtrails. Our food is being GMO'd. Is there some kind of terraforming? Maybe they're going to take over. It's another alien race, and that's how they're taking over. They're not going to do a war, but they're just going to breed us out of existence and kill us off with pollution.
Well, I think what's happening is that they are reforming the Earth into something that they can live comfortably in, and that they are reworking the human race to something more akin to themselves. That's what I
think. Is anybody seen the Anunnaki in their experiences? And are we see? We started this with Neil, and back in 42 or 43, the Anunnaki came with the Greys, and they were their workers. So this is the mystery. Is this a sentient life form that's rebelling against, and Dr. Lesson wants to talk, the Anunnaki? Are they androids? And, okay, he's not going to talk. Okay. Well, thank you, John. Let's kind of stick on the Anunnaki, but go ahead.
I personally think that they are androids, and that they are, a manufactured race.
Okay.
Yeah, I think there is to be a bit facetious about it, John. I think that there is some place out there in space where there is a big manufacturing plant, and they're called Hondroid, and they put out all different types of gray androids. But on the other hand, if I listen to the words of some alien species that seem to be communicating to us at different times, there is also a race of grays that is natural, in other words. They interact with other species on an independent basis. I don't know, it's frustrating in the sense that it's very, very difficult to get any kind of direct proof, and so you have to kind of keep an open – I just try to keep an open mind about all of it and, try to put the pieces together.
I think it's both.
Thank
certainly,
you for the information, John.
John, the Enki created an android to rescue Inanna after Eriskigal had killed her, and he made him out of ceramic materials, a regular data, life and the bread of life, and brought Inanna back to life. And some of the painting and drawings and so forth are exactly what we would call a gray. And in the wall of Pumukpuku, there are grays as well as turbaned, bearded people and Nigerian-looking fellows and coneheads, and so that there's been lots and lots and lots of contact, and we just because of the truth embargo, it's hard to really get hold of the information, but it's consistently gotten out, and we have direct experiencers and lots of remote viewers, and it's obvious to me that there's both, like Neil says, there's both, there's the androids and there's a natural race of these grays too.
Right, and we're left with testimonials. We're not really getting any, strong physical evidence anymore. And so we have all these, we don't know if they're my labs, if it's mind control, if it's actual. Sometimes people have stigmata. I had stigmata a lot of times from my experiences where I had markings. So, but that's been a long time since I've had any kind of markings. So we're just left with a dilemma here. What do we do with this information, and how does the ancient tie into the modern, and who are the Anunnaki left? Have they really left it back to a bunch of humans to run? I don't think so. I think that Enki's he's leaving messages in the crop circles. I think that's his territory, and I think there is some kind of intervention going on with the royals, and I think it's Enlil, Yahweh, and I can't prove it, but that's just where my research is going. What did you want to say, Dr. Lesson?
I think the history, if we see what really happened, and we will no longer have to keep repeating it. Gandhi said, if we keep going an eye for an eye, pretty soon the whole world will be blind. And I think that we just have to respect the consciousness of every being on this planet. We have to encourage everybody's light to shine. Reality is an elephant, and just because the people at the top of the elephant, the thugs that run the world today, think it should be one way, that's just their view. We need everybody's light, and I think that's getting free of the God spell will allow us not to do what certain people from another planet tell us to do, but to see what's in our interest. And if the Anunnaki, I guess as Neil put it, come back with their gold digging equipment and says, back in the mines, boys, we can say, what do you got to trade?
All right, we're going to have to continue this on Sunday's show. We're running out of time, so we got about 4 minutes. Let's start with the youngest first. Alex, 30 seconds. Say something, and we'll pick it up again on Sunday. Say goodbye to our people.
Yeah, I mean, I
don't. Listeners.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. I just want everybody to keep researching and have an open mind. Research on your own. Don't just trust what anybody else says. Just like, you know, we've all done our research, and I encourage everybody else to do that. Once again, my book is In the Beginning, The Epic of the Anunnaki, and you can get it at inthebeginningthebook.com. And thank you again, and hope to join you again soon.
Okay, thank you. Bob.
Yes. These ships are coming into our system every single day. Back in August of last year, I recorded 10 of these ships coming into our system or departing from our system. NASA tried to shut me down. I'm still here. So whatever they're doing it every single day.
All right. Thank you. Sasha.
We have nothing to fear. Be yourself fearlessly. It doesn't matter if you die. If you haven't lived, what difference does it make? And as far as optimistic or pessimistic, be optimistic, because if you're wrong and things turn out junk, at least you'll have a good time before that.
And finally, Neil, closing words.
Well, to take up off your last words there, I'm signed up for cryogenic suspension with Alcor, alcor.org, and I've had it with the diaper trip on no more incarnations from scratch again. C.B. Scott Jones and I say that if you want to know what our think tank is about, it's about the leading edge of the leading edge. Of human evolution. Let's get it on. We can't wait for anybody. We can't wait for disclosure. We're just gonna go for it ourselves and create our future.
Oh,
thank you. So I hope you all join us again on Revolution Radio. That's our big show, and it's on Sunday, 8 to 10. I invite you all back. We're going to do another roundtable. Let me know, send me an RSVP that you're going to show up or not. If you can't, that's okay. We're going to do this again. We're going to keep on this topic here because these are our ancestors. I think Neil said that. A lot of interesting aliens out there, but this is mom and dad and grandma and grandpa, and we want to know what's going on, and we want some answers. And I think doing this think tank here, sign me up for your think tank, Neil. You have any final words, Sash?
Enki saves.
Enki saves. And thank you, everybody, for joining us for our Good Friday. We're going to get into Jesus.
Moses and Beth.
We want to know more about Jesus, and Sunday is appropriate. So thank you, everybody, for joining us, and much love and aloha from Maui, Hawaii.
Good night. Good night.
Good night, everybody. Thank
aloha.
You so much.
Yeah.
All right.